there's moonbeams in your elbows, and there's rivers in your hair. And I wanna see you forever, babe, forever. Don't take me back in time now, but there's nothing for me there. Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, presented by Purina Pro Plan. On today's episode, we're going to handicap the race. There's a horse racing term for you. For a new farm bill before the end of 2025, while also covering a variety of federal policy topics comprising the Washington, D.C. waterfront. Joining me, and you can probably predict the two people who are joining me, Andrew Schmidt, PF&QF's Director of Government Affairs and our resident Baltimore Orioles Rube, and he nods in agreement, and Ariel Wiegard, PF&QF's Vice President of Government Affairs and coming off recognition as the most valuable professional for the organization in 2024 and 2025, the 25 fiscal year for us. First of all, Ariel, congratulations on being the MVP. Well, I rolled with most valuable professional as opposed to player, but I don't know how you feel about professional or player.
I'm fine with either one, Bob. That's great.
Congratulations.
It's nice to be recognized. It's nice to feel seen with most of our staff out around the country. Sometimes Andrew and I are alone here in Washington, D.C. We can feel a little out of the fold. So it's nice to have our efforts recognized. Absolutely.
Well deserved. You've been with the organization about a year and a half.
No, almost 2 years. Finally,
almost 2 years.
I can say almost 2 years, the first week of September.
Wow. Time flies, huh?
When you're having fun.
Yeah. And Andrew, are you at 4 years? Am I recalling?
Yep. Four years in November.
Okay.
So I feel like I'm past the, like, when you have a kid or you get married, you do like the months thing until it's like 18 months. Then you can just start doing years and stop having to measure the months. So Ariel's just about there. It's just, it's going to be the year now and we don't have to remember when during the year.
So as this comes out, this episode will be mid-August and the Baltimore Orioles are firmly out of the playoff race, correct?
Correct.
How many players did you trade at the deadline?
You know, it's been a rough couple of weeks of explaining the trade deadline to a 7-year-old.
Oh.
He's kind of come to terms with it, I think. My 4-year-old though is still playing imaginary baseball games with Cedric Mullins, still on the Orioles. So we're working through it as a family.
That is tough. You hear people talk about when players get traded, the impact it is on their family, but you never really, well, rarely do you think about the little kids that, you know, their baseball idols get traded away to another team and the shock that is. Although the Orioles don't really have any superstars to speak of.
Okay. All right. I thought we were in a friendly place here.
Yeah, I know.
If we want to go that route, we can.
No, they'll be young and upcoming soon.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We got a lot of good years ahead of us. Gotta get through this one.
All right. Speaking of 4 and 7-year-olds, you like that transition?
Don't know yet where it's going, but I do like it so far.
Really excited about this.
It's recess in Washington, D.C. right now, the August recess. So, Ariel, what does that mean that it's recess? I have visions of people in suits and sandboxes. Is that accurate?
Sure. Yeah, let's go with that. I think that's fine. No, not people in suits in sandboxes. People usually shed the suits by August. It's pretty steamy here in the swamp. And really, I mean, most people have gone home. That's what recess is. So, you know, just like the 4-year-olds and 7-year-olds in school. recess is a time for folks to stretch their legs, you know, after sitting at a desk all morning, or in this case, since January 3rd, when Congress came into session. They've had a couple of short recesses, but they've earned a little bit of an extended break here at the end of the summer. But, you know, I think it's important to note they don't go on vacation. So lawmakers, they go home to their states and districts. They do see their families for a few weeks. But more importantly, they're there to connect with their constituents. You know, they do town halls. They go around and visit, you know, different precincts in their district or different parts of their state. Go out on field tours for conservation. We've got some folks doing that this summer. But yeah, it's a time for folks to go home, reconnect with their voters about the things that matter. Some of them are struggling with that right now. There's some pretty passionate voters out there on the countryside who are feeling frustrated with Washington. But yeah, it's a time to take a break from legislating. And honestly, it's a break for folks like me and Andrew also. We get to take a short breath, recalibrate a little bit, get ready for the long push that's pretty much going to take us from Labor Day through Christmas.
Are staffers from the elected official, they work in every day, or they have a little bit shortened hours at this point too?
No, staff are still there. Some of them might have shorter hours, but they're still there. You know, folks are on their summer vacations still. And so you've got a lot of people coming to DC to see the sights. And I have some friends who just did a Capitol Hill congressional tour on Friday. And they said that it, you know, in the rotunda, it was just standing room only. It was absolutely packed with families. And so somebody's got to show them around and somebody's got to greet them when they go to the office. And we are still working. You know, Andrew and I are both going to have interactions with Hill staff here during August. So yeah, it's recess, but the work isn't really over. It's just sort of a lighter workload with the lawmakers out of town.
And the big benefit is for me anyway, I don't have to wear a suit when I go downtown during recess. So I think that in and of itself lightens things in the summer.
If folks haven't been to Washington, D.C., they probably have no concept of how oppressive the humidity is in the summer. I went back to D.C. at Ariel's invitation to record some podcasts a year ago, and I think it was in August.
It was July or August last summer, and it was steamy.
It was really steamy. And it's called a swamp for a reason, because the humidity gets you. Ariel, I'm going to ask you a somewhat difficult question, because I don't think that there's an overall correct answer. But I'm curious about if you can profile a Washington, D.C. Hill staffer. And what I'm curious about are these folks that aspire to one day run for office, or are they hoping to climb the ladder in agencies, or what is, because the ones I've met are, you know, early to mid 20s, very ambitious, super sharp. What's their career objectives when you think about Hill staffers?
That is a challenging question. I don't think that there's one answer. A lot of folks come to DC because they feel sort of a civic duty. They feel pride in their country and their government, and they want to be involved in the political process some way. Some people do want to be career politicos, we'll say. It could go a couple different directions. Some of them have an issue area they want to work on. They might be very passionate about conservation or about energy policy or about healthcare or taxes or whatever it might be. And so they want to get experience in that area. Some of them might want to run for office someday. A lot of them, I think, want to run for office someday. Some of them come off of their boss's campaign staff. So maybe they worked on a House campaign or a Senate campaign back home, and then their boss kind of recruited them to come out to D.C. as well. I mean, it's really a wide range.
Sure.
But, you know, I think the message, and what I always tell folks when they are coming to D.C. for the first time, is just to be nice to everybody. Treat everybody respectfully, because you never know when the intern who's taking you on a tour is going to be the next speaker of the house, yeah. Right? We have seen that happen. And so you just want to treat everybody as though they're going somewhere, even though that, you know, that's not always the case. And, you know, we do see a lot of people just end up going home, or going in completely different career paths after being out here. They realize it's not quite the right fit for them.
And it, to throw a cookie crumb out there to folks, and I'm thinking about the teenagers and the early 20-year-olds listening who are dreaming of a career in conservation, this is an opportunity to have potential massive impact on what you care about, habitat, hunting heritage, and that's, you know, volunteering with a local elected official, helping be part of a campaign, and then potentially move into DC, as you mentioned, and being part of a staff and help shaping future farm bills or conservation policy. You just never know where that path could lead. And this is a really viable way to have a massive impact if you have some smarts and a little bit of serendipity of being at the right place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We would love to see more people with a passion for conservation, for hunting, for just outdoor recreation generally. Would love to see more people filling seats in Congress. It would make our jobs a lot easier if the people we were talking to knew more about the issues, had more personal experience with them. I will also take this one step farther, though, and say not just for young people getting into their early careers, but also maybe some of our more established listeners who are involved in their communities. Get out and run for office. You know, it's not just the staff who are important to the future of our work. You know, there are fewer hunters in this country broadly, and there are many more fewer hunters in Congress and in the Senate and in, you know, state office as well. And so if you've ever felt that call, if you've ever felt that civic pride bubbling up inside you and you feel like, oh, I could maybe do this, I would encourage you to get out and do it. We would love to see more of our supporters winning elections and getting into those seats where they can really help make a difference.
Right on. Yeah, we definitely need folks that care about conservation, care about public lands, and that's what we'll talk about next. We're going to recap a bit of the early part of the summer to start, and then we're going to handicap the push towards a new federal farm bill as we look into our crystal ball towards the end of 2025. So that's the meat and potatoes of this episode of On the Wing podcast. Before we get rolling, I want to thank Purina Pro Plan one more time as our presenting partner of On the Wing podcast and the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. All of my pups eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the wildlife habitat conservation mission of our organization, which is incredibly important to me and should be important to you, but the most important element is that Purina Pro Plan is a team of the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their dog food. Purina Pro Plan was built, it was created for the working bird dog like yours and like mine. Learn more at ProPlansport.com. All right, as I mentioned, heading into the meat and potatoes of the episode, let's recap the early part of the summer. And there's no way of putting it other than, you know, May, June, it was a wild ride. So let's start with the public lands recap. Ariel, tell us about what happened or attempted to be put into play in Congress. Start with the House, lead to the Senate, and recap that whole shenanigans, for lack of a better term.
Shenanigans is a great word choice. Love that. Love that. This is good. Before I do that, though, maybe just a little stage setting. So a recap of what the process was and why we were in this situation to begin with. So there was a public lands provision included in the budget reconciliation bill that was moving through Congress. And so what reconciliation is, it's a special process in Congress that allows for, we'll call it streamlined consideration of certain budget-related legislation. So it means that Congress can make changes to spending, to revenues, to the debt ceiling, to things that really come down to dollars and cents, but with fewer hurdles than you need for regular legislation. So, for instance, in the Senate, you typically need 60 votes, but with reconciliation, you only need 51. You need a simple majority. And so that means that you can typically get by with support from only one party to get something done in Washington, which is, as things have become more partisan over the last several decades, this is one of the main tools that Congress is using to get things done. And so I just want to emphasize that this is really a tool for sort of single party legislation to move forward. But it's not used by just one party. So a few years ago, when President Biden was elected and when Democrats held control of the House and the Senate, they passed the Inflation Reduction Act. That was back in 2022. That was full of all kinds of climate provisions. And we'll talk about some of the cool stuff for conservation that was included there in a minute, I think. But that was done under Democrat control using the reconciliation process. Before that, Republicans used it for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act when President Trump was in office the first time. You know, it kind of ping pongs back and forth, and we're seeing action from both parties. And that's kind of where we are today and why this process was being used this spring, now that we had President Trump back in office and Republican control of both the House and the Senate. So here we are, it's 2025. President Trump wants to get a bunch of stuff down quickly, kind of knows that time is limited before we get back into election season in 2026. So President Trump and Republican leadership on the Hill were using this reconciliation process to move the party's priorities forward. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the bill that we were not paying any attention to. I mean, on a personal level, we were paying attention, but PF and QF, you know, they weren't priorities for us. But one thing that we didn't know was going to be a priority was the inclusion of these provisions to sell off some of our public lands. So you mentioned it started in the House. Mm-hmm. There was a provision in there that would have sold off several 100,000 acres of land in Nevada and Utah. And our community rallied pretty hard. And we got those provisions taken out of the House bill before the House voted on it. And then they sent the bill over to the Senate. Unfortunately, the land sale provisions came roaring back in the Senate. Senator Mike Lee from Utah, he holds the chair of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, which has oversight of most of our public lands, included a new provision that would have upped the land sale to several million acres, mm-hmm. not just in Nevada and Utah, but across 11 Western states. And, I mean, truly, I have not seen a response like what we saw in response to this proposed sell-off. I mean, the entire outdoor community rallied, and people were calling their lawmakers, sending emails, going after them on social media, going to state and district offices, asking Congress to take this land sale provision out of the bill. I mean, you had hunters and anglers and mountain bikers and retirees and RVs and teachers, and I mean, literally everybody who's ever set foot on public lands came out in opposition to these provisions, and we were very fortunate to get them taken out of the bill here at the last minute before the Senate voted on it. And so from that perspective, we got sort of a clean bill, clean of the public lands provisions before it was sent to President Trump for signature.
Yeah, I think about the 23 years I've worked for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, and I can't recall anything generating as much of a response as the pushback against the public land sale. But I'm wondering, do you think our elected officials, you know, they certainly felt it because it was taken out. How long will that last? That feeling of, whoa, I probably shouldn't mess with public lands and this audience of hunters and anglers and outdoor enthusiasts. Is that, you know, that I haven't witnessed any topic generate as much response as that as this did at the end of June and into almost the 4th of July.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, this a push to sell public lands comes around every, you know, decade or so. Back when I worked for the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership several years back, there was sort of a big land sell-off movement that happened back then. You know, I wouldn't expect it to go away entirely. Senator Lee still holds the gavel on his committee. He will for at least another 18 months here, and I wouldn't expect him to drop the issue entirely. This is something that's been important to him for a long time. So, no, it's not going away. I would say that our community needs to be vigilant.
You know, will the passion from both public land hunters and sportsmen and women and conservationists and the members of Congress who stood up for public lands, will that go away? I think the showing that we've seen from the community, from all throughout the country, and from members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, rallying in defense of public lands and in defense of the process, the fully, you know, formed process to dispose and manage public lands. We've now seen the power that we have to make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think once we see that, we're encouraged, again, as a community and as those members of Congress to continue standing up for what we're passionate about. And I do think we'll see that continue. We've seen the earlier this year, even before kind of this reconciliation process kicked off, the Public Lands Caucus, a bipartisan caucus, was formed in the House of Representatives initially, and it includes as Republican co-chair and vice chair, Ryan Zinke, who used to be Secretary of the Interior from Montana, and Mike Simpson, who is from Idaho, and he's the chairman of the House Interior Appropriations Subcommittee. Like two really influential people when it comes to public lands and public lands management in Congress. So I think seeing them really put a flag in the ground and standing up for it, I think is really encouraging. And I do think that'll have some staying power going forward.
Yeah. Well, I want to take a moment and thank all the listeners, all the members, all our social media followers that did raise their voice, whether that was through social media, through an email, a phone call to the Capitol switchboard. You absolutely made a difference. And, you know, we are very prudent about when to sound the alarm and ask for help. So when we do, when Ariel gives the bat signal and it comes out through our organization, that means we need you. And you guys and gals across the Upland community came out and let your voice be heard. So we cannot thank you enough. That made a huge difference. And collectively with all the other organizations out there and the folks at Meat Eater did an amazing job. We just have so much thanks for people that were engaged in the process. It meant turning back a budget reconciliation ploy to sell public lands to balance the budget. And that was just that's just not the right way of going about this. So thank you. I'm going to stay on the access train for just another moment, but rather than, you know, the public lands sale, I want to talk about the budget that did go through and my favorite acronym, VPA HIP, Voluntary Public Access Habitat Incentives Program. And while it might not be my favorite acronym, it is one of my favorite Farm Bill oriented programs. Andrew, tell us the good news about what was in that budget for public access hunters.
So yeah, when we talk about a hyper-partisan process like reconciliation, we can't discount the fact that there are opportunities for bipartisan priorities to be included in the bill. And one of those was VPA HIP. So the Voluntary Public Access and Habitat Incentive Program is funded through the Farm Bill, and it funds state agency walk-in access programs. So we've talked about this before, where you have a, you know, whether it's North Dakota's Plots or WEHA in Kansas, Open Fields and Waters in Nebraska, all these state agencies have their public access programs, and many of them are funded through this this pot of money in the Farm Bill. And it last received a significant amount of money in the 2018 Farm Bill, where it got $50 million. But outside of 1 year in 2024, where it received like a $10 million stopgap during the extension of the Farm Bill, it has not received a plus up since 2018. So as part of this reconciliation bill, VPA HIP received $70 million, 70, to be available through 2031. This is by far the most significant investment in public access for private lands for hunting, fishing, wildlife-dependent recreation since 2018. So we're really excited about these programs, these state agencies being able to secure long-term funding for walk-in access, which will boost local economies, hunting opportunities. You may not see VPA HIP on a lot of signs when you walk onto a field, but I guarantee you, if you've hunted publicly accessible private lands throughout the country, there's a very good chance that it was funded and made possible by this program.
Yeah, it's a... It's sort of the new age of the way, at least I think about Farm Bill programs, which is layering, right? Stacking benefits on top of benefits on top of benefits. And if you think about CRP acres out there on the landscape, they have generally been the foundation of the house upon which walk-in programs have been built by states. And this added allocation of VPA HIP dollars adds more money to the pool for states to grow those programs, as you mentioned, whether it's WEHA or Plots or, you know, OLAP in Oklahoma. You pick your favorite state, and most of them have walk-in programs, and increasing the amount of money available from the federal government to these state agencies trickles to the landowner to open up their property and makes CRP more lucrative if they're willing to open it up for public access, because it adds an additional benefit. It's a fabulous, fabulous program with tremendous benefits. And every public land hunter I know takes advantage of walk-in programs across the country for quail, for pheasants, for prairie grouse. Let's stick with the budget bill for one more additional bit of good news that was part of the budget, and that was another acronym Ariel mentioned a moment ago, which is the Inflation Reduction Act. How does that come into play with the budget bill, Andrew?
Yeah, so like Ariel mentioned, in 2022, Congress passed, Democrats in Congress and President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act. And as part of that huge bill, there were about $20 billion in conservation funding for Farm Bill programs. So there's a whole litany of acronyms that it funded, but it funded a lot of programs implemented and delivered by the Natural Resources Conservation Service, NRCS. And what the IRA, some people call it IRA, I'm so glad that now we never have to worry about which one it is again. The IRA dollars were set to expire in 2031. So this $20 billion was one-time funding. And it also came with some what came to be known as climate sideboards or climate guardrails, where the money had to be spent on what were deemed climate mitigation practices by USDA. But what the reconciliation bill that passed in July does is it rescinds the dollars from the IRA, but it reinvests them immediately into the Farm Bill's conservation baseline. So what does that mean? Well, the baseline is the starting point for crafting any future Farm Bill. So this is assumed, this money is assumed to continue on, doesn't have to be reappropriated or refunded. So lawmakers and the ag committees can use this money for these highly popular, highly oversubscribed and underfunded programs into the future. This was one of PF&QF's top priorities for this farm bill, because we've seen, again, how popular and how effective these programs are for working landscapes, for farmers and ranchers, for hunters, as we talk about, you know, some of these programs are going to fund prescribed burning and thinning and forest stand management in the Southeast, or they're going to fund establishing cover and conservation cover and habitat in, you know, in other parts of the country, and you know, nutrient management or cover crops, no-till agriculture, all these things. It runs the gamut of different things you can incentivize on private lands. So it's really exciting now that we can look at an increased farm bill title baseline. So again, like when you look at the numbers, the farm bill baseline overall for 10 years, they usually score on like a 10-year period. Before this this bill was passed, was about $60 billion over 10 years. That's a lot of money. That's a huge amount of money. Mm-hmm. With this reinvestment of IRA funding into the baseline, that number over 10 years is now closer to $75 billion. Hmm. And that continues long-term in perpetuity for future farm bills. And that gives us a lot more to work with Congress to get more conservation on the ground and meet the needs of more farmers and ranchers and producers.
And you mentioned it's got wide-ranging benefits across the country, from the prairie grouse range, sage grouse, pheasants. But what's music to the ears is probably our quail audience, that EQIP in particular gets some additional funding. And that's, you know, arguably the number one tool in the Farm Bill toolbox for the bobwhite quail range. The missing element of the budget bill is CRP. There's no component of that IRA dollars that addresses CRP going forward, is there, Andrew?
That's correct. And a big reason for that, the main reason for that, is that when the IRA was passed in 2022, it didn't include CRP as one of those programs that it boosted funding for. And the main reason for that was, as a lot of our listeners know, CRP is an acre-based program. You're allowed to enroll up to 27 million acres nationwide at any point in time. It's really hard to infuse kind of a one-time, here's a bunch of money to just use on that. Whereas with other dollar-based programs like EQIP, it's easier to say, here's a pot of money, use for the next 10 years. So CRP was not in this last, bill that passed in July. But with two of our top three farm bill priorities, so IRA funding and VPA HIP, with those largely addressed through this bill, we're now able to devote more time and attention specifically to building support for improving CRP, in this next farm bill.
Wonderful transition, because that takes us to the heart of the conversation. You know, I want to spend a little time recapping what has happened already this summer, but the most important element now is looking forward. So let's start with, you know, I just mentioned at the intro that Ariel won the MVP for FY25 for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever, which ended June 30th. That's our budget year, runs July 1 to June 30th. The federal government's budget year is a little different than ours, isn't it, Ariel?
It is. The federal government's budget year runs from October 1st to September 30th. So we are coming up on the end of the federal fiscal year.
And what's that mean for keeping the government going? Are we in the clear? It seems like you've been here 2 years. Every quarter we have a threatened government shutdown. Do we have to be concerned about that as we head towards prairie grouse season?
Yeah. I've been here for just about 2 years, and I think this will be my 9th government shutdown threat. So it is becoming a pretty regular thing at this point. Yeah, Congress has got to figure out how to fund the government. You know, they had this big budget reconciliation bill, but that was really targeted at specific budget line items. It wasn't the entire budget for the entire federal government. So they still have to go through the regular appropriations process in order to fund the government for the full fiscal year. And, you know, things are pretty tense. Things are pretty tense in D.C. right now. It's yet to be seen if Republicans and Democrats can come together to pass a full funding bill. They certainly won't be able to do it by September 30th. They haven't gone through the full appropriations process for every committee yet. So we're most likely going to see a continuing resolution, which would just continue to fund the government at current levels until Congress makes some sort of a change.
Okay.
Whether that's a full year continuing resolution or just to kick it a couple of months, maybe until the end of the calendar year, and then we'll have to go through all this again in December. That's a possibility. But it's pretty unlikely that we're going to get a full new FY26 funding bill from Congress before October 1st.
And that is what's been keeping farm bill programs going, as continuing resolutions over the last 2 years. Is that accurate?
Not quite, no. So a lot of these farm bill programs, the ones we've been talking about, the conservation programs, they, because of the Inflation Reduction Act, had continuing authority. So regardless of what happened with the farm bill, they were reauthorized and extended in the IRA back in 2022, and again just now in the One Big Beautiful Bill here in 2025. So regardless of what happens with a farm bill, those programs are just going to keep functioning. They have funding, they have authority, they're good to go. There are some other programs that were also addressed through the One Big Beautiful Bill. Farm safety net programs were in there. They're going to be fine beyond September 30th. There are other parts of the farm bill also that have that permanent authority, like the crop insurance program. They'll keep rolling. It's everything else that doesn't have that authority, and they don't touch that through the regular appropriations process. They're going to have to do some sort of farm bill extension or reauthorization or a new farm bill, rather, if we want to see the farm bill continue from October 1st forward.
And that's where CRP lands, in the latter, correct?
Correct. Yep. And so for the last 2 years, so the current farm bill that we're in is the 2018 farm bill. It expired September 30th of 2023. Mm. And we're now on our second 1 year extension. And that extension, again, covers all of those other programs that don't have permanent authority, including CRP.
So CRP hangs in limbo beginning September 30th.
October 1st, so, technically, but...
Okay, right, yep. right on, because we have until midnight.
We have until midnight September 30th.
Give us a state of CRP from your seat.
So CRP right now has a 27 million acre cap, right? So we talked about this when I was on the podcast in May, when we're in the middle of a signup, or just finished a CRP signup for this fiscal year. You know, CRP stands at right about 26 million acres enrolled. So we have a million acres underneath the cap now. And then we have just under a million acres expiring come October 1st. So that leaves us with 1.8 million acres of room to enroll starting October 1st. So we just finished, the general signup finished earlier, a little bit earlier this summer. They are just closing up a grassland CRP signup that was open since mid-July. And then the continuous signup, which is usually ongoing and continuous, was only also open for a couple months this summer as they took a little bit of time to get it up and running following the Farm Bill extension last fall. So with CRP, right now we don't know what happens after October 1st without authority. We know that they can't enroll new acres without extending that that authority a year into the future, at least. They can continue servicing existing contracts, excuse me. So anything that's enrolled by the end of this fiscal year will get paid. Those contracts are valid and will continue. But really the next step for the program is needing to reauthorize it and extend it into the future, whether through a farm bill, an actual farm bill that will pass and extend it for 5 years, or through some kind of extension along with those other farm bill programs that Ariel mentioned.
We had a bit of news at the very end of July related to CRP, and that's the CRP Improvement and Flexibility Act, introduced on July 31st by Senator Thune, Republican out of South Dakota, Senator Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota, Jerry Moran, Republican out of Kansas, and Tina Smith, Democrat out of Minnesota. And I highlight that you got two R's and two D's, which is normally a very good sign for legislation moving through Washington, D.C. What does the CRP Improvement and Flexibility Act mean for pheasants and quail, Andrew?
Yeah, and I'll start by saying not only two D's and two R's, but the two lead co-sponsors on this bill, Senators Thune and Klobuchar, who also introduced the CRP Improvement Act in previous Congresses. We have Senator Thune, who's the majority leader of the United States Senate, and Amy Klobuchar, who is the ranking member of the Ag Committee, the Senate Ag Committee. So when we look at the co-sponsor list and the bipartisan support for this bill, it's really exciting and really encouraging. So in the last couple Congresses, the CRP Improvement Act was introduced, and folks may have seen PF and QF supporting that bill. This bill does a number of things that will really greatly improve CRP as a program with little to no cost and budgetary impact for doing so. A few things that it does, and these are all really at the top of our list for our Farm Bill priorities when it comes to CRP. So it will restore mid-contract management cost share. So what does that mean? So just like it sounds like, management activities are required about halfway through every CRP contract. This is to ensure that the cover continues to provide wildlife benefits along with soil health and water quality. So a lot of times this looks like prescribed burning. We love it when this is prescribed burning. Spraying, light disking, interseeding, grazing and haying is also often used. Prior to the last farm bill, USDA provided 50% cost share. So the federal government paid half of the cost of doing these activities, which are required. But that farm bill removed that cost share. So it's been a top priority for PF and QF and a lot of our partners to restore that authority in this farm bill.
I would just think about that visually from a bird hunter's perspective. CRP's largely 10 to 15 year contracts, right? And if we're talking about mid-contract management, so we all know that the best years for bird production are kind of that year three when, you know, the CRP diversity of habitat gets established. And, you know, by the middle of those contracts, you can tend to run into some monocultures, whether that be brome or whatever. So, you know, having management prescribe burning come through in the middle part of those CRP years that it's enrolled is absolutely just can be a juggernaut for creating the best possible habitat for birds. So having the federal government come back and provide some funding to make that happen for the landowners, you know, greases the skids to absolutely better habitat for all those acres and is squarely in the bullseye for what Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever wants to see happen. So not to jump in on you there, but I was just thinking about, you know, how important mid-contract management is within CRP. You know, people can look at CRP that's been on the landscape for 15 years and never been touched. And while there's some benefits, when there can be some habitat management components to that CRP contract, boy, it can just escalate the benefits for the landowners, but for also folks that want to see wildlife on the landscape.
Yeah, absolutely. And along the same lines of management, the bill also provides cost share for grazing infrastructure. So producers are allowed to graze their CRP contracts, no more than once every other year on the same acre. So you can do 50% of your contract each year, or all of it every other year, in exchange for a payment reduction. And what this bill does is it helps producers install fencing and water distribution practices to facilitate grazing during and after that contract. So it's when we talk about prescribed burning is a lot of times our a preferred practice. Grazing is along those same lines of a preferred activity and way to manage those grasses and knock them back to allow a more diverse stand to emerge. That's on the management side and grazing. The bill also permanently establishes SAFE, which is the State Acres for Wildlife Enhancement Initiative, in the continuous signup of CRP. It sounds really wonky. It sounds really, kind of vague. And what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So the biggest benefit of being in the continuous signup is that it's a non-competitive, meaning first come, first serve opportunity. So it comes with extra incentives for establishing the cover and in a lot of cases, improved rental rates to reflect the higher priority practices being enrolled. So for wildlife, SAFE is a partnership with states to specifically tailor practices to address their priorities. So could target a species like bobwhite quail or pheasant, sharp-tailed grouse, or it could be more generally focused on early successional habitat, sagebrush restoration, pollinators, wetlands. It looks different in each state. It's a way that CRP is really a locally led and state-focused, state-tailored program to address what's on the ground in that state and in that ecosystem.
Yeah, if you were to put the center of the bullseye of a continuous program that benefits what we're after, bird numbers, it's hard to come up with anything. Maybe upland buffers, CP33s, but SAFE is about the best possible option out there.
And the biggest, I think the biggest and most understated provision in this bill is it includes an increase in the payment limitation for what a producer or landowner can receive from CRP in a year for rental payments. So when CRP was created in 1985, it set a limitation of $50,000 a year in rental payments. So if you're a landowner and you're enrolling in CRP, you cannot receive more than $50,000 a year in your rental payments. That has not been changed since 1985. There are a lot of things that have changed since 1985, but that is not one of them. So this bill increases that limitation to $125,000, which puts it closer in line with changes in land values, changes in inflation, and other economic factors to allow people to continue enrolling their land, their marginal and environmentally sensitive land, in CRP. I've heard from, and our field staff have heard from countless producers and contract participants in CRP that they want to enroll, 20 more acres of this filter strip. They want to enroll, a few more acres of their marginal pasture land and grassed waterways or whatever it is. They want to enroll more, but they can't because there's no financial benefit to doing so. So they're forced to continue losing money farming, those acres. So this, again, has the potential to really make a difference on the ground for landowners who are at the window, banging on the door, trying to get in the program, get more acres in the program, and they just can't.
As you talk through our priorities for CRP, it occurs to me, there was an era where it was all focused on acres, exorbitant numbers, 50 million acre program, where you're hitting a variety of bullet points, which are, to me, strengthening the foundation elements of the program to make it financially viable for landowners. Because when landowners win with CRP, when it is competitive with their other options, everybody wins with CRP. Is that an accurate assessment, Andrew?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I mean, we are, there are studies, study after study are showing that we are losing farmers and losing farmland in the United States. And a lot of times that is happening because the economic, feasibility of farming is just harder and harder every single year with input, input costs rising, crop prices continuing to fall in a lot of places. And it's harder and harder to farm. It's harder to stay on the land. And CRP, we've talked before about it being a part of the farm safety net. It is a tool to help producers stay on the land. And we've seen through precision ag and, advancements in technology and data use that producers can see where they're losing money, where the acres are red, right? We like to talk about turning red acres green, and they can see where they're losing money. And CRP provides a home for those acres that will then turn a profit for on-farm revenue, diversify on-farm revenue, and keep their productive acres in operation. And we absolutely see CRP as essential as part of that equation, because otherwise you have a lot of producers who are forced to farm these marginal acres. They are losing money, but there is no other option. And if they keep losing money on those acres, it's not going to be worth it to farm any of their stuff. So CRP is a tool, and a really effective tool to managing risk and increasing on-farm revenue.
As we round out the CRP Improvement in Flexibility Act, any other priorities, Andrew, that are related to CRP that you want to highlight as we go into the farm bill debate?
Yeah. So, I mean, for starters, I'll say that all the provisions I mentioned above included in the CRP Improvement and Flexibility Act are many of our top priorities for CRP. And those will go a long way in bolstering the program. But it's impossible to talk about strengthening CRP without talking about rental rates as a whole. The 2018 Farm Bill decreased CRP rental rates by 10 to 15%, depending on the practice. And we knew this as a community, and PF&QF knew this going into the last Farm Bill, as it was a primary means of paying for increasing the cap from 24 million acres to 27 million acres. Now, rental rates aren't the only factor that determines whether a landowner enrolls in CRP, but it's a big one. Obviously, crop prices, input costs, operational costs, they all play into that decision and are all outside of our control. But for PF&QF, we want to better incentivize the enrollment of marginal lands, highly erodible acres, areas less suitable for crop production, where CRP delivers the greatest conservation and economic return for farmers and taxpayers. So we're really interested beyond this this bill that we talked about in tailoring these incentives and rental rates to better encourage enrollment of marginal lands and ensure that CRP remains a smart and efficient investment in our rural communities.
All right, so there's a lot to iron out in the coming months. And there will be a time, undoubtedly, that we ask our members, our social followers, our listeners to engage, to help us out and raise their voice, whether that's to thank folks like Senators Thune, Klobuchar, Moran, and Tina Smith for introducing some phenomenal legislation that is filled with our priorities, or to push back on something that, you know what, isn't going to do what we want for the birds, water, soil, or landowners. Ariel, how should folks kind of engage? What do you want folks who are listening to be on alert for?
Well, stay on alert for us to put out the call, send out the bat signal, like you mentioned earlier at the top of the call, Bob. I think you're absolutely right. You know, there may be an opportunity to thank the sponsors of the legislation that we've just talked about, to oppose or defend against negative things that we don't want to see happening. But something else that I think we really want folks to be doing is just showing support for the program and telling Congress how much they love CRP. You know, something that you and Andrew talked about the last time he was on the podcast was the fact that people usually call their congressman when they're upset about something. You know, but like we saw with the public lands debate, there's something bad happening. You know, please stop it. That's the request. It's not every day that you get hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of people calling their congressmen and senators to say, we really like this program and we would really like to see it continue. That's pretty rare. And so I think one of the things that we're going to be doing here in the coming weeks is launching another action alert, just like we saw for, so we put out for the public land sale debate back in May and June, asking folks to just send those messages of support up to the Hill. We enjoy CRP. We like having it on the land. I'm a farmer. This program works for me. It's part of the farm safety net. I hunt here with my children and grandchildren. You know, just sharing all of those positive messages about all of the great things that CRP brings to the landscape. So we'll be facilitating some of that through our new action alert tools. We'll be putting them out over our social media channels. So, you know, everyone out there, don't forget to smash those like and subscribe buttons, you know, on your social media of choice. But yeah, we're going to be pretty vocal on it in really just a couple of weeks here. And then we're going to keep those stories rolling as long as we need to, as long as this farm bill debate continues on without modernization and improvement of CRP, and certainly without reauthorization of CRP for another 5 years.
And special bonus points for folks that integrate their favorite CRP moments into their Grain Belt premium moments from the field. We've got the new or renewed partnership with Grain Belt Beer coming online. And we've got prize packs in play for folks that share winning stories with us. So if you're able to weave in a CRP story, I'll be on the lookout for those as I share the stories on the podcast. It was super fun last year, so I hope folks engage in that as well as we go forward.
If they weave it in half as good as you weave that read in, I'm going to be blown away.
What do you think? You know, bird hunting, habitat, and a Grain Belt premium on the tailgate, right? With a story about CRP.
Perfect.
It's like the grand slam. If only the Orioles could hit a grand slam. I know. I shouldn't be too haughty. My Tigers are falling apart. As
one winning season. As a Tiger fan is just like.
All right. I'm going to close with a question that is darn near impossible to ask, because as we mentioned, or Ariel mentioned, we haven't had a new farm bill since 2018. And that's, Tom Brady was still playing in 2018. He won his sixth Super Bowl in 2018. It's been a long time, but I am going to ask each of you to handicap the horse race towards a new farm bill. We won't say September 30th because Ariel basically said that that's going to be a real challenge. But in terms of, will we have a new farm bill by the end of 2025? Andrew, unfortunately, you have to go first. Ladies, go second.
Well, I was going to, the one thing I was going to say, the last time we had a farm bill, the Orioles were selling at the trade deadline. So that's how.
So that's a good sign.
Feels like it was just last week, man, but it was a long time ago. You know, it's I mean, with the caveat that a lot can happen before the end of the year, it's going to be really hard. I will also say that, whatever farm bill happens, last year there was a rush to get a farm bill done, but it was the end of a Congress and there's a new election. And they had to start over all over again with the new Congress, earlier this year. That is not the case. Now they could do a farm bill in February or March or April. Now deadlines spur action. I'd probably put a little under 50%, personally, but, I will, I guess, qualify that with when we do get a farm bill, whether this year or next, I think we're really well positioned for PF and QF and things like CRP and things like other conservation program improvements that we're pushing for. I think we're in a really good spot. It's just a matter of when.
Let me ask a quick clarifying question. The CRP Improvement and Flexibility Act, can that get passed without a farm bill, or is that only integrated into a new farm bill?
So technically, yes, it can pass into law now. It's what's usually called a marker bill. So since the farm bill comes around in theory every 5 years, a lot of that interim, especially the year or two leading up to when a farm bill needs to be passed, is spent introducing a lot of these marker bills that are really just, we're introducing legislation that will then be cut and pasted into the larger 800, you know, page bill. And this is one of those. So it's set up as a mark. So then when the farm bill ultimately passes, these senators can say, my bill was included in the farm bill. Mm. That said, I mean, we've kind of already, you know, the farm bill has already been being done in different places, right? We saw some of it being passed through the reconciliation package. Mm-hmm. It is possible. It is not likely that this would be passed on its own, but when we talk about a skinny farm bill, it's a matter of how skinny it actually is. It could all be kind of rolled into a package along with funding the government and pass the kind of stuff outside of the funding that we did earlier in the year. So I would not expect to see a press release saying this bill passed on its own. But the hope is that it's picked up and put in the middle of a larger package that's being negotiated.
Cool. All right, Ariel, you get to look in the crystal ball next and tell us what you see.
For the sake of debate, and a little tension here in the government affairs team, Andrew handicapped us a little bit below 50%. I'll go just slightly above 50% for getting a farm bill done this year. I think, a lot of the groundwork has been laid to get a farm bill done. You know, the House Agriculture Committee in the last Congress held a markup on a Republican-led but bipartisan bill, meaning that they debated it in committee and then they voted it out of committee. It never made it to the floor. It never made it past that point. But there is a template. There is a bill that the House especially could use to move it forward. And we've heard from Representative G.T. Thompson, the chair of the House Agriculture Committee, guest of the podcast last summer when you were in town, Bob. Very nice gentleman. Incredibly supportive of farmers and of sportsmen as well.
Yeah.
Big background as a hunter. His parents owned a sporting goods store when he was a kid. I mean, he's definitely on our team and wants to see something done. And he said that he's going to try to do another markup of his bill in September 2025. So just a few weeks from now. So we'll see if the House can, you know, find time to get that done. But if they do, I think there's some really good momentum there. They don't have to write a bill from scratch. It was GT's bill last Congress. And so maybe we could get some Republican support and some bipartisan, maybe more moderate Democrat support to get the bill moved out of the House and then sent to the Senate for a vote. We also have to consider that, you know, while a lot of farm bill provisions have been addressed in other ways, as Andrew just mentioned, as we were talking about with the reconciliation bill, there are elements to a farm bill that need to be addressed beyond CRP that farmers are really eager to see addressed. So we've got our provisions. The farm groups really need to get something done before December 31st, we run into some problems around permanent law, which I don't think we need to get into all of the nuances here. But if we don't get a farm bill done by the end of the calendar year, in some respects, we would revert to 1930s, 1940s farm policy. Congress has left some very old farm laws on the books specifically to ensure that we're regularly updating a farm bill. And some of those laws would kick back in on January 1st. And we do not want that to happen. It would not be good for markets. It would not be good for farmers, for consumers. So something will need to happen by the end of the year. I think we would, most of us would like for that something to be a new farm bill. So yeah. I'm gonna give it the 50% plus one and see if I'll be in favor of getting it over the finish line this calendar year.
It's like crossfire on the wing.
If I think back, 4 or 5 months ago, there was very little optimism about a new farm bill in 2025. To me, the winds of positivity seemed to be blowing towards a farm bill coalescing this year. And I think about it, not just within our community, Ariel, as you mentioned, dairy producers and, Farm Bureau, like there are entities beyond hunters that would like to see, a 7-year farm bill be the last extension, right? Like let's get some new legislation here that puts some certainty around a lot of different livelihoods. So that I'm going 75%, but I know virtually nothing. So we'll go positive.
If we could get everyone to have that 75% optimism, I think this thing would self-propel itself across the finish line. So let's put it out there into the universe, Bob. I think that's great. We'll manifest it into existence.
Push for it.
Sounds like my optimism of the Orioles season about a couple months ago.
No, let's not compare the farm bill of the Orioles, Andrew. Let's not do that.
I think a lot of good things are going to happen with the Orioles in December in the winter meetings. So maybe that's when we pass.
There we go. Some free agent signings. Well, folks, thank you for listening. Please stay engaged to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever on our social channels and our emails. If you are not yet an email subscriber, please sign up on the website. That's probably the speediest way to know what's happening and when we need your help to raise your voice for conservation policy in Washington, D.C. For Ariel Wiegard, the MVP. For Andrew Schmidt, the Director of Government Affairs. Thank you both for joining me for this episode. And I'm certain we will be back talking again before the end of the year. Hopefully it's a celebratory podcast to talk about what's in the new 2025 Farm Bill. So fingers crossed. Folks, thank you for listening to this episode. I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks, folks.